This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's access media station, Plains FM, and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Haere mai koutou to Duct Tape and Flip Flops, the show where Josh
and Josh
put a spotlight on some of the Kiwi geniuses who are tackling some of the world's biggest problems with nothing but their skills, smarts, and sometimes even a handy roll of duct tape.
On top of that, we'll be sharing one of our favourite Kiwi waiata to broaden your horizons.
This is Duct Tape
and Flip Flops.
And welcome back to Duct Tape and Flip Flops for 2024!
Yeah, yeah!
I don't have air horns set up on the soundboard right now, but if I did, I would be spamming that button.
Spamming that button, indeed.
So hard. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Josh.
And I'm Josh.
Just for a yearly introduction, thank you very much for tuning in, people. We've had a great time away, but we're also very excited to hit this year ground running, even though we're a little late to the start of it in Feb.
Yeah, a little.
Sorry about that. We've got stuff to do, but I'm very glad to be back here in the studio and to ask our first question of the year. This is going to be a long question, longer than normal, but Josh, with the many sophisticated advancements in technology that are coming out these days, how do you think that they can be utilized in the field of agriculture?
Agriculture.
Yes.
Sounds like a very interesting field. Indeed. Well, agriculture is a bit of a funny one because any old person can, you know, buy a horse, buy a plow, and plow their fields, I guess. I have no experience in agriculture. Remember, we're novices who, like, you know, mostly at home, kind of dwell in the studio, but maybe go out for runs and bikes every now and again. But in our agriculture field of vastly novice knowledge, so to speak, like, agriculture has some very fundamentally traditional principles. And seeing AI and, like, tech and that is like, whoa, that's weird. But at the same time, you know, past 100 years, we've got tractors, we've had, you know, massive advancements in plowing and sorting vegetables and fruit and using chemicals and fertilizers to help grow things better. So yeah, there's been lots and lots of advancements in the past 100 years, but none of them have sort of been very machine, very computery focused until kind of now when, you know, all this AI stuff is coming in and it's incredible how it's been implemented and used. You know, we've got it day to day for use for ChatGPT and yeah, they can ultimately, sensors give numbers, and if the AI knows how to process something, then surely it can do something with those numbers, right?
Yes, it can. We're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit, as we tend to do. But yeah, there's a very interesting discussion with an earlier episode, one of our last episodes of last year, around AI, which was obviously the buzzword for last year that was used all over the place. But there's a good distinction to be made between, you know, AI as you might understand it from the movies, you know, truly artificial intelligence, and more so what we're working with at the moment, which is machine learning. And as Josh mentioned, a lot of the things in farming are using sensors to recognize when certain things are happening, to process information, to understand what's happening out in, you know, in your field. So if you could teach a computer through something like machine learning to understand what is being put through a sensor, to interpret images, to understand those images, and then save the farmer work on having to do that stuff themselves and be able to sort that all into nice, handy data sheets and stuff, that would be, I'm saying this like it's a thing that doesn't already exist, that would be a really convenient thing. And we just so happened to have the wonderful chance to speak to someone who has been working in this exact field.
Yes, that person is an amazing person from Lincoln Agritech. I think they're based in Lincoln, Christchurch, so that's pretty awesome. And it's a weird way of thinking farming is making, you know, radical tech advancements. And it's been doing so a little bit behind the scenes because a lot of the projects that Lincoln Agritech and all the other companies have done have been on very small scale. But, you know, as these ideas come out and as they work with developers specifically who actually want to implement these ideas, we can see possibly an increase in the next couple of years, couple of decades.
I'd certainly hope so. And we'll get more into what Lincoln Agritech are specifically after our song. Which we've gone a little left field. I don't know if you'd say left field with our choice for today, but something a little a little more under the radar, our artist for today is Dopra, which is a duo piece of producer Stephen Ma and vocalist Indira Force. This particular song comes from their 2016 album, currently their only album, which was recorded in a music studio right here in Littleton. Well, I say right here. Technically, we're in Christchurch. Littleton is on the other side of the hill. But I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, they're an electronic group, but this album was recorded with half electronic instruments, half live instruments. The album is Wasting. It's quite cool from the tracks that I've heard of it so far. And in particular today, you'll be listening to Machinery. Hopefully you enjoyed the song, and I quite like it, so I'll be listening to the rest of the album after recording today. But yes, today we're diving into a fairly local company, Lincoln AgriTech. They're a multidisciplinary research and development company, is how they describe themselves on their website, basically meaning that they are packed to the brim with really cool scientists and engineers who are working on issues all over the board, from climate change, environmental sustainability, food security, primary sector productivity. Those are the main ones that they list themselves. Basically, if there's something that a scientist could do that is vaguely related to agriculture or this idea of agri-tech in a way, they're taking a look at it and they're finding a cool new way to do it.
Yeah, pretty much. That's a great way of summing it up. And they are also a branch of the Lincoln University, which is based, funnily enough, in Lincoln. So a lot of Lincolns there. Lincoln AgriTech, based in Lincoln University in the town of Lincoln.
I wonder where they got the name from. But we had the wonderful pleasure of speaking to Jaco Fowry, who's got a PhD in computer vision from UC right here in Christchurch. And he's been working with Lincoln AgriTech for 11 years. We'll let him tell the rest, but enjoy the interview.
Well, we have Jaco with us. So tell me as much as you know about the founding story of Lincoln AgriTech.
Oh, okay. Well, Lincoln AgriTech's a pretty old company. It was established in 1964, so definitely before I got there. They were originally known as the New Zealand Agricultural Engineering Institute, and the goal originally was mainly to apply research to accelerate agricultural engineering. And most of the work they did back then was around testing, especially safety testing of heavy agricultural machinery. That's basically it. I know about the founding in the early days of Lincoln Agritech. It was a while ago.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems to have stayed mostly around the same principles as today. Would that be a correct description of it?
It certainly expanded beyond its original goals. Back then, it was mainly engineering. It was mainly working with agricultural tools and agricultural machinery. Now, Lincoln Agritech is an independent research center that spans many different disciplines, scientists from many different disciplines. We act almost like a Crown Research Institute now, a little bit, but independent.
Right. And I'm guessing a lot of innovation comes out of that as well.
Yeah, historically as well. Even back then, there was quite a few interesting technologies that came out of Lincoln Agritech.
Yeah. So tell us, what is your expertise?
I did my PhD here at Canterbury, at Canterbury University in Christchurch. And my background is in machine vision and image processing. So that's what I did most of my work in. These days, because machine vision and image processing was almost taken over by machine learning and AI, now I specialize more in machine learning and more general signal processing and data science. We still work in image processing and machine vision, but that's a field that's not as popular as it used to be.
Yeah, that makes sense. Obviously, AI has been a big buzz term for the last year. But how do you apply those very specific and very cool skills to something like agriculture?
Yeah, that was actually a question for me when I got to New Zealand myself, because I never thought I would work in agriculture. I wasn't planning to work in agriculture, that's for sure. But actually, there's a lot of work in agriculture because the kind of sensing required in agriculture is often most easily and logically done with a camera. When farmers go out in their fields, they look at their crops, they count their fruit. This is all things that you do visually. And that's what machine vision and image processing is all about. It's trying to teach a computer, trying to write software that see like people do. So teaching a computer to see like a person would, but using a camera. That's essentially machine vision.
Yeah, that's really awesome. Now, coming into that a little bit more, so what projects have you worked on during your time at Lincoln Agritech?
Well, I've been at Lincoln Agritech for almost 11 years now, so that's a lot of projects. But briefly, I've worked in horticulture, in viticulture. I've done some work in forestry, more general robotics as well. So I've worked in horticulture specifically. We did a lot of yield estimation and cropped estimation. We developed tools that allow farmers to monitor their crop load, apples on the tree, so counting the number of apples on a tree before and after thinning, for example, and doing this in a fast, automated way instead of manually counting it by eye. In forestry, we've done a few robotics projects, so just developing robotic systems that can navigate in a forest environment safely and robustly. There's also been some projects in viticulture, so in wine grapes, where we developed machine learning tools that can identify good pruning solutions. So when they prune the grapevines, that's a very skilled task. And if you're trying to automate that skilled task, the first thing you need to do is actually first figure out what these pruners are using to solve their problems. What are they looking for in the vine architecture that actually tells them this is the, how you should be pruning the vine? And then the next step would be to now show that to a robot so that the robot can do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we'll come back to the apple pruning a little bit later. But for now, into your, what's it called, the forestry robot you guys have created. So can you tell me a little bit more about this fully autonomous machine learning four-wheeled box-looking robot you guys have concepted and created?
Yeah, so that's actually quite an old project now. We started that project originally quite a few years ago, and it was just a robotic platform back then. And the goal was that we would develop something that the forestry industry can use as a robotic mule, something that they can use to carry heavy tools or machinery. But the key point was that it had to navigate by itself. In an environment where you often don't have GPS, so it's very difficult for robotic navigation systems to be accurate in that environment. And then the other big problem was the environment itself is incredibly rugged and rough. You've got high hills and deep gullies and rocks everywhere, and the slash from the forestry make it difficult to even walk. So the mechanical engineering side of that project was very challenging. And then the sensor side as well, because this robot had to work alongside humans, which means it had to be very conscious of where everybody was to be safe. It's a big, heavy robot, so it's quite dangerous if it runs into someone. So we had to be very careful with the human detection aspect of it, which in a forestry environment is quite difficult because of all the vegetation and all the slashes you can find on the ground. So the robot had to know where the people were, even when they were partially occluded by vegetation.
Right.
And that's where we started. We're now at a point where we've actually got a, not necessarily a robotic platform, but a system that we're trying to commercialize, whereby you can buy it and attach it to any commercial robotic platform, and it makes it semi-autonomous. Like rugged for navigation.
Yeah, yeah. To be crystal clear, what does this robot actually do in the forestry scene?
Okay, so the robot you're probably referring to, the one that we've got on our website, like I said, that's quite an old one.
Yeah.
And that robot was mainly, had mainly two purposes. One was to carry sensors for surveying, doing things like pest monitoring and weed detection. And secondly, it was a mule. It could carry things.
Right.
But we developed it as an, I wouldn't say an exercise, but as a proof of concept to show that we could have a robotic platform that can navigate the rugged terrain and can navigate even when you've got a pine forest with pine needles that make it very difficult for GPS to work. Because the pine needles act like little antennas. They block GPS signals.
Cool. And you said obviously that this is a bit of an older project that you guys have worked on, and that it was a way of proving that you could, you know, use things like the pine needles to aid in the navigation. What have you guys learned from that that you've then taken on to the later projects that you've worked on?
Well, I think one of the main things that we learned is we didn't fully appreciate how rugged the terrain really was and how difficult the navigation problem really was. I've worked in agricultural environments in the past, in orchards, and vineyards, dairy farms, and in my mind, that was quite a robust and rugged environment for anything electronic and robotic to work in, but it's nothing compared to forestry. I would say if something manages to work in a forest, it will work anywhere.
Yeah, for sure. And so, where do the needs for self-learning robots able to work in harsh conditions arise from?
Well, in many industries, like forestry and agriculture, potential tools for automation must be adaptable to change as the task changes and as the environment changes. So advanced robotics, the ones with the ability to sense and respond to changing environment, in a smart way, are still very expensive. And for these robots to be economically viable to the industry, they must have multiple uses. They must be multi-purpose, and they must be future-proof. And so they need to be able to change when the task changes and when the environment changes. And so to make it economically viable, ideally what they would have to do is they would have to adapt and learn from their own experience or from other human workers. But this is a very ambitious goal, and it's something that we are still trying to achieve. We're working towards a truly self-learning robotic system. But what we've done thus far is just achieve good steps in that direction. So, yeah, for example, a robot that you can just give a rough path on Google Earth, and it then can know how to navigate that rough path in a rugged forest environment.
Wow, that's quite impressive. And it sounds like you guys have been really good at creating systems that would be quite useful, because it would be really handy to have, you know, the ability to carry these bits of machinery on something that can track its own path. We've found an article that you spoke in where you're quoted as saying, "It's not all that difficult for us to come up with a great idea and to try to make the industry agree, but in reality, it's better to work on something that they actually want." What do you think makes it important for you to develop these awesome concepts alongside the people actually working in these industries?
Yeah, this is actually something I feel quite strongly about. My experience with past projects have shown me that many, and I would even say the majority of projects that are led by universities and research institutions like ours, they end up delivering a very scientifically impressive prototype model. But then at the end, it gets stored in a shed and it's never seen again. And the reason for that is because the way that these projects work and the way that they get funded is the funding lasts until this point, until the point you have a prototype. And because it was mainly, you know, led by a university or a research institute, the industry does not necessarily care enough about that output, even though the industry may have been involved. They might not care enough about that output to actually then take it and invest more money into it so that it can be matured into a commercial product that can then actually be useful. And so it never goes anyway. And the reason for this is academic and scientific research projects, they have different goals. They care about novel science. They care about developing new techniques, about producing academic outputs like research papers, whereas what the industry really cares about is a practical, economically viable solution to their problem. It's not that important to them that it's a novel scientific output. It's really something that they can use practically. And to get to that output, they have to lead it. They have to come up with the idea. So in my opinion, better way for us to serve the industry as scientists is to just make sure that the industry is aware of our abilities, that the industry is aware of the latest technology, that we showcase these things as they become available, but then let the industry take the lead and let them take that knowledge and come to us with their problems and their potential designs, and then we can have a conversation and talk about potential solutions. And then if they lead that process, they will also be more invested in it. And I think that is what leads to a project that actually delivers a product that you can use.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that answer. Obviously, that means a lot to people who, you know, want to develop stuff, but then maybe it hits a dead end when funding comes to an end. It's really awesome to have that industry recognition for projects like that. So this is very crucial. And your perspective... Yeah. Having worked on cutting-edge projects such as this robot and, as you mentioned before, the apple tree pruning, several others, I'm sure, why is there a need to experiment and tinker with new concepts rather than to be satisfied with what we have?
Well, yeah, maybe I'll give a personal opinion there. I'm a scientist, right? So I'm interested in technology and research, and you know, this is why I get up in the morning. And especially when it relates to fields like image processing and AI, you know, machine learning, these are fields that move incredibly fast. You have to stay up to date all the time. So as a scientist working in this field, And you have to continually be learning and experimenting with new techniques to remain relevant at all. And that's what tinkering is. By tinkering with these new ideas and these concepts, whatever, that encourages new thinking and encourages you to think about learning alternate, possibly better ways to solve a problem you've had before. And you can't really learn this. You can't really apply these new techniques unless you build it yourself. You have to really get in there and get your hands dirty and really do it instead of just reading about it. So that's what tinkering is to me. It's important to get hands-on experience, to know what's going to break, to know what the limits are, to see how you could improve it or adapt it for other purposes. That leads to innovation.
Yeah, definitely. And finally, are there any more projects you guys are working on that kind of sound cool?
I'm currently working on an interesting project actually in the food processing industry. It's a project that's led by the University of Canterbury, and they are working with milk factories. They want to develop a sensor that can sense fouling or foreign objects in milk pipes, in pipes that process milk. And it's a big problem for the industry because when these pipes get dirty or when they get some foreign object in them, the factory needs to be shut down. And obviously there's lots of economic loss in there. And you can't really have a sensor that sits inside the pipe because that obviously influences the cleanliness of the system and the quality of the milk. And so we're actually working on an electromagnetic sensor that sits outside the pipe and can sense these foreign objects or fouling building up in the pipe just by the magnetic field and electric field that we generate around the pipe. So it's quite a high-tech, very interesting project, and I'm learning a lot about electromagnetic fields.
Yeah.
That's one interesting project, yeah.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jacko. It's been a real honour talking to you.
Thanks, Josh.
Now that we've run our mouths for long enough, we'd love to thank Plains FM for producing this episode of Duct Tape and Flip Flops.
If you'd like to get in touch, you can email us at the address on our Facebook page, and make sure to give us a follow while you're there.
Sometimes it might feel like life's getting a little bit boring, but if you've got a cool idea, don't be afraid to make it heard.
It could turn out to be the next big Kiwi innovation.
Ka kite anō.